Blog Talk Radio.
Scanners that detect weapons as people walk by on streets. Whoa, that's really
Without, yeah, without even telling you?
It's about 10 minutes, but I think this is interesting. Goddamn Bloomberg.
After the tragic shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, across the country, people are trying to find ways to make communities safer. In New York City, police hope to catch illegal gun carriers with full-body scanners. The device is called Terahertz Imaging Detection. It works by scanning a targeted person head to toe and can detect when someone is carrying a gun. As the scanners do its job, those targeted have no idea they're being scanned. So is this a new way to keep our streets safer, or is this an invasion of privacy?
Yeah.
To discuss, I'm joined now by Danny Panzella of Truth Squad TV. Danny, great to have you on.
Thanks
for having me. So can you tell us more about this new technology and how exactly it will be used?
Well, that's still up in the air. The NYPD says they're studying it, how exactly they can implement it. Early reports were that they were going to be mounting these scanners in trucks or the back of police cars, and as they patrol the streets, they'd be scanning the pedestrians, walking up and down New York City streets. And if they see something that resembles a gun, then that they would use that as their reasonable suspicion to perform a search. So Ray Kelly, the police commissioner, is saying this is going to actually reduce stop and frisk, because they'll only have to stop and frisk people that they actually see have weapons. But we who fight NYPD injustices know that this will be used as an excuse to stop and search anybody, because now anything can look like a weapon. Anything can look like drug paraphernalia. If I'm carrying a pen, are they going to say it's a syringe or a knife? And now they have a legal justification that covers them to perform a stop that really would be illegal otherwise.
So this technology, it doesn't sound like this technology is very accurate, where they, whatever it detects, they know in fact that it is a gun.
Well, obviously the closer the subject is to the technology, probably the more accurate of a visual they will get. But no, I mean, if you're scanning as you're driving up and down the streets, people are moving, it's going to be very difficult. To really accurately, I mean, obviously the shape of a gun is going to be more obvious than a pen, you know, but they're not only looking for guns. Gun confiscations as a result of stop and frisk is like a 0.01%. So the majority of stop and frisks basically yield drug paraphernalia, you know, things of that nature, small weapons like knives that are maybe a little bit too long to fall within the law, that type of stuff. So, you know, to say that this is going to stop guns is really disingenuous. But there's just the issue of it's an invasion of privacy. There's no warrants involved. People don't even know they're being virtually searched with this technology.
So that's a big issue in itself. You know, this whole that they're supposed to have permission, I guess, when police stop you and conduct these searches. There's supposed to be some form of evidence, but I guess in this case it kind of gives them a free pass. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. The scanner itself can act as the evidence. So all they need to say is, well, it looked like a gun on the scanner or it looked like a knife on the scanner. That gave us the justification to stop this person, and then we found nothing. So they can blame it on the technology. It becomes a scapegoat.
Right. Going along with this justification that it will make us safer, I mean, in some scenarios, I guess they can, because they will be presumably be able to identify people that actually are carrying weapons. Do you think it's worth giving up some of our freedoms in the name of safety, especially in the wake of some of these tragic shootings that we've been seeing?
Absolutely not. The NYPD's own numbers prove that they are not confiscating guns as a result of this policy. So now to just take it a step further and say we're just going to scan everybody without consent and without any kind of evidence under the guise of keeping us safer is absolutely ludicrous, and it is a complete violation of the Bill of Rights.
All right. You know, it's interesting that this comes up, because we've been reporting a lot about how basically these new things that are popping up that kind of infringe on our privacy, and it does seem like we're being filmed everywhere that we go, especially when you're in a big city like New York City. So is this just kind of, you know, just the new norm?
Well, obviously they're going to encroach on our liberties as much as we allow them to, and that's why I'm encouraging everybody to get in touch with your legislator and tell them, we're not going to tolerate being scanned without consent. I mean, at least if they're stopping and frisking somebody, that person has the option to assert their rights and say, you don't have the right to stop me unless you have seen me committing a crime or you believe that I just have committed a crime. At least there's some sort of reasonable suspicion. But if they're just stopping people at random now because they have this machine that they can use as their scapegoat, this will just be one more encroachment, and we have to protect our liberties. There's really no there's no justification for it. It actually infuriates me because this stop and frisk tool that they call it is only being used in certain neighborhoods, and it's not an equal application of the law. So there's so many problems with it. Not to mention the health problems that come along with the terahertz scanners. The MIT put out a report saying that terahertz waves actually tear apart DNA. That's the phrase they use. So there's a huge health risk that should be studied before these are implemented as well.
Wow, and we are seeing the backlash just recently. The TSA news that they're going to be removing those controversial scanners that they put into airports across the country. They are now removing those. So we are seeing a backlash to these kinds of technologies that people find invasive.
I noticed that.
I want to ask you, you said there's privacy concerns. Do you see this as a concern to our constitutional rights, constitutional concerns?
Yes, absolutely. It is absolutely an invasion or a violation of the Bill of Rights. This is an unwarranted search. It's a virtual search. They may not be touching you, but they are searching you without you knowing it, without any proof, without any warrant. The founders were very clear in the wording of the Bill of Rights that if you suspect someone of a crime, you have to go to a judge, get a warrant, and it has to be based on very specific information. You need to provide, you need to say, I want to search their person because I believe they're carrying a gun for XYZ reasons. It's not just, well, we just think he's a criminal because he's wearing baggy pants, so we want to search him.
Wow. Do you fear or anticipate that this could become the norm, a new method that police departments across the country are going to implement?
Absolutely. This is part of a federalization campaign, and the NYPD serves as a model for police departments not only in our country but all over the world. So they basically what they do is they beta test these technologies. You know, there's 100 other things that they're testing right now, including iPhone apps that actually facially recognize. They can scan your face and scan your eye and take a biometric reading of your eye, and then they put that in their database. They're testing that right now, the NYPD. This is all coming from grants from the Homeland Security Department. They're funding the technology. It's a way for the federal government to take control of police departments. They buy influence with saying, well, we're going to give you the latest crime-fighting tools, this technology that you'd never be able to afford on your own. We're going to give it to you. All you have to do is send all the information back to us, and they do that through the NYPD Intelligence Division. Which is a fusion center.
Very interesting and eye-opening. I appreciate you coming on and telling us all about it. Unfortunately, we are out of time. That was Danny Panzella from Truth Squad TV.
That was very interesting. So the federal government is buying their way into local police departments.
Yeah.
Here's a tank that you can use in rural Kentucky.
Yeah. You got to surprise me because number one, Bloomberg is probably the most.
Oh, there go. Is that the one?
What?
No, that isn't the one.
No.
I'm looking for the one that gives the history of the exploitation of the Irish by the English. It's really a good article.
I didn't see that.
Well, it's gonna keep going.
I did. I thought I'd like to hear this one.
Psychiatry to label entire families with a mental disorder.
This is what worries me about this gun control laws.
Mental health
stuff. Yeah. It's really true. Too much history of normal, abnormal, and the norm. It's the paradox which we should attempt. Aberration is so plentiful as to form a terrible normality of their own, descend upon us with frightful consistency. Number of massacres in history, for instance, are almost more than we can record. There was the New World Holocaust, consisting of the extermination of indigenous Native Americans, people,
People throughout the Western Hemisphere.
I got hiccups here, so extending over four centuries or more, continuing into recent times in the Amazon region. There were the centuries of heartless slavery in the Americas and everywhere, followed by a full century of lynch mob rule, Jim Crow, segregation in the United States. But today, the numerous killings and incarceration of black youth by law enforcement agencies. Terrible normality. Interesting, though. It's amazing that one in three black American men are incarcerated. One in three.
Or half them.
Or half them.
This is by Michael Parente.
Dandelion salad. Number of massacres in history, for instance, are amongst more than can record. The New Holocaust of Native American people throughout the Western Hemisphere, extending over four centuries or more, continuing into recent times in the Amazon region. There were the centuries of heartless slavery in the Americas, endless
and elsewhere,
followed by a full century of lynch mob. I just read this.
Mm-hmm.
But go ahead. You want to read the rest?
Let's not forget the extermination of some 200,000 Filipinos by the U.S. military at the beginning of the 20th century. The genocidal massacre of 1.5 million Armenians by Turks in 1915, and the mass killing of African peoples by Western colonists, including the 63,000 Hero victims in German Southwest Africa in 1904, and the brutalization and enslavement of millions in the Belgian Congo from the 1880s until emancipation in 1960, followed by the years of neo-colonial free market exploitation and repression in what was Mobutu Zaire. French colonists colonizers killed some 150,000 Algerians. Later on, several million souls perished in Angola and Mozambique, along with the estimated 5 million in the merciless region now known as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The 20th century gave us, among other horrors, more than 16 million lost and 20 million wounded and mutilated in World War I, followed by the estimated 62 million to 78 million killed in World War II, including some 24 million Soviet military personnel and civilians, 5.8 million European Jews, and taken together, several million Serbs, Poles, Roma, homosexuals, and scores of other nationalities. In the decades after World War II, many, if not most, massacres and wars have been open or covertly sponsored by the U.S. national security state. This includes the 2 million or so left dead or missing in Vietnam, along with 250,000 Cambodians, 100,000 Laotians, and 58,000 Americans. Today, in much of Africa, Central Asia, and the Middle East, there are smaller wars, replete with atrocities of all sorts. Central America, Colombia, Rwanda, and other places too numerous to list, suffered the massacres and death squad exterminations of hundreds of thousands, a consistency of violent horrors. In Mexico, a war on drugs has taken 70,000 lives with 8,000 missing. There was the slaughter of more than 500,000 socialistic or democratic nationalistic Indonesians by the U.S.-supported Indonesian military in 1965, eventually followed by the extermination of 100,000 East Timorese by that same U.S.-backed military. Consider the 78 days of NATO's aerial destruction of Yugoslavia, complete with depleted uranium and the bombings and invasions of Panama, Grenada, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, Western Pakistan, Afghanistan, and now the devastating war of attrition brokered against Syria. And as I write, early 2013, the U.S. sponsored sanctions against Iran, acceding severe hardships for the civilian population of that country. All the above amounts to a very incomplete listing of the world's violent and ugly injustice. A comprehensive inventory would fill volumes. How do we record the countless other life-tearing abuses, the many millions who survived wars and massacres but remain forever broken in body and spirit, left to a lifetime of suffering and pitiless privation. Refugees without sufficient food or medical supplies or water and sanitation services in countries like Syria, Haiti, South Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, and Mali. Oh, God, it's awful to read this.
It is. Think of the millions of women and children around the world and around the centuries who have been trafficked in unspeakable ways, and the millions upon millions trapped in exploitive toil, be they slaves, indentured servants, or underpaid laborers. The number of impoverished is now growing at a faster rate than the world's population. Add to that the countless acts of repression, incarceration, torture, and other criminal abuses that beat upon the human spirit throughout the world day by day. Let us not overlook the ubiquitous corporate corruption and massive financial swindles, the plundering of natural resources and industrial poisoning of whole regions, the forceful dislocation of entire populations, the continuing catastrophes of Chernobyl and Fukushima, and other impending disasters awaiting numerous aging nuclear reactors. The world's dreadful aberrations are so commonplace and unrelenting that they lose their edge, and we become inured to the horror of it all. Who today remembers the Armenians? Hitler is quoted as having said, while plotting his final solution to the Jews, who today remembers the Iraqis and the death and the destruction done to them on a grand scale by the U.S. invasion of their lands? William Bloom reminds us that more than half the Iraq population is either dead, wounded, traumatized, imprisoned, displaced, or exiled, while their environment is saturated with depleted uranium from U.S. weaponry, inflicting horrific birth defects.
What?
We've been talking about this ever since 2003.
What is to be made of all this? First, we must not ascribe...
I just wanted to mention one thing before you continue.
Let me just finish the sentence. First, we must not ascribe these aberrations to happenstance, innocent confusion, and unintended consequences. Nor should we believe the usual rationales about spreading democracy, fighting terrorism, providing humanitarian rescue, protecting U.S. national interests, and other such rallying cries promulgated by ruling elites in their mouthpieces.
I remember back in the 70s, I went to school with a guy who was an Armenian, and he was in my class. He was an Armenian. He was a radical, he would go around everywhere and spray paint, try to make people remember the Armenian massacre.
They don't even mention it in history books.
There's another great massacre that nobody remembers is the Ukraine. The poor people in the Ukraine. That in 1933, millions of Ukrainian people were starved to death, all right,
mm-hmm.
by the Russians, because and their wheat and their food was confiscated, stored up in stockpiles, and exported,
mm-hmm.
all right. And the Ukrainians were starving. 1933 was this famine. Mm-hmm. It was a man-made famine. They had plenty of food, but they weren't allowed to eat it. Imagine that.
Yeah.
And there were millions of Ukrainians that died during that time.
How about what happened to the Hungarians?
Oh, I mean, everywhere in the Eastern European,
uh-huh.
African, American, you name it, and these sons of bitches are out there killing everybody. And yet nobody seems to know, even remember,
nope.
that these things are happening. And they're happening daily. They're happening everywhere. And we've tried so hard to
The repetitious about. Patterns of atrocity and violence are so persistent as to invite the suspicion that they usually serve real interests. They are structural, not incidental. All this destruction and slaughter has greatly profited those plutocrats who pursue economic expansion, resource acquisition, territorial dominion, and financial accumulation. Ruling interests are well served by their superiority in firepower and striking force. Violence is what we are talking about here, not just the wild and wanton type, but the persistent and well-organized kind. As a political resource, violence is the instrument of ultimate authority. Violence allows for the conquest of entire lands and the riches they contain, while keeping displaced laborers and other slaves in harness. The plutocratic rulers find it necessary to misuse or exterminate resistive multitudes, to let them starve while the fruits of their land and the sweat of their labor enrich privileged coteries.
Thus, we had a profit-driven imperial rule to help precipitate the Great Famine in northern China in 1876 to 1879, resulting in the death of some 13 million people.
Oh, my God.
At about that same time, the Madras Famine in India took the lives of as many as 12 million, while the colonial forces grew ever richer. And 30 years later, or earlier, the Great Potato Famine in Ireland led to about 1 million deaths, with another desperate million emigrating from their homeland. Nothing accidental about this. While the Irish starved, their English landlords exported shiploads of Irish grain and livestock to England and elsewhere at the considerable profit to themselves. These occurrences must be seen as something more than just historic abnormalities floating aimlessly in time and space, driven only by overweening impulse to happenstance. It is not enough to condemn monstrous events and bad times. We also must try to understand them. They must be contextualized in the larger framework of historical social relations.
The dominant socioeconomic system today is free market capitalism in all its variations, along with its unrelenting imperial terrorism. Free market capitalism provides normal abnormalities from within its own dynamic, creating scarcity, maldistributed excess, filled with duplication, waste, overproduction, frightening environmental destruction, and varieties of financial crises, bringing swollen rewards to a select few and continual hardship to the multitudes. Economic crises are not exceptional. They are the standing operational mode of the capitalist system. Once again, the irrational is the norm. The irrational is the norm. Consider U.S. free market history. After the American Revolution, there were the debtor rebellion of the late 1780s, the panic of 1792, the recession of 1809, lasting several years, the panics of 1819 and 1837, and the recessions and crashes through much of the rest of the century. The serious recession of 1893 continued for more than a decade. After the industrial underemployment of 1900 to 1915 came the agrarian depression of the 1920s, hidden behind what became known as the Jazz Age, followed by a horrendous crash in the Great Depression of 1929 to 1942. All through the 20th century, we had wars, recessions, inflation, labor struggles, high unemployment, hardly a year that would be considered normal in any pleasant sense. An extended normal period would itself have been an abnormality. The free market is designed inherently unstable in every aspect other than wealth accumulation for the select few.
What we are witnessing is not an irrational output from a basically rational society, but the converse, the rational to be expected output of a fundamentally irrational system. Does this mean these horrors are inescapable? No, they are not made of supernatural forces. They are produced by plutocratic greed and deception. So if the aberrant is the norm and the horrific is chronic, then we in our fight back should give less attention to the idiosyncratic and more to the systemic. Wars, massacres, and recessions help to increase capital concentration, monopolize markets and natural resources, and destroy labor organizations and popular transformative resistance. The brutish vagaries of plutocracy are not the product of particular personalities, but of systemic interests. President George W. Bush was ridiculed for misusing words, but his empire building and stripping of government services and regulations revealed a keen devotion to ruling class interests. Likewise, President Barack Obama is not spineless. He is hypocritical, but not confused. He is, by his own description, an erstwhile liberal Republican, or as I would put it, a faithful servant of corporate America. Our various leaders are well-informed, not deluded. They come from different regions, different families, and have different personalities, yet they pursue pretty much the same policies on behalf of their same plutocracy. So it is not enough to denounce our atrocities in war, but also must understand who propagates them and who benefits. We have to ask why violence and deception are constant ingredients.
Unintended consequences and other oddities do arise in worldly affairs, but we also must take account of the interest-driven, rational intentions. More often than not, the aberrations, be they wars, market crashes, famines, individual assassinations, or mass killings, take shape because those at the top are pursuing gainful expropriation. Many may suffer and perish, but somebody somewhere is benefiting boundlessly. Knowing your enemy and what they are capable of doing is the first step toward effective opposition. The world becomes less of a horrific puzzlement. We can only resist these global and local perpetrators when we see who they are and what they are doing to us in our sacred environment. Democratic victories, however small and partial they be, must be embraced. But the people must not be satisfied with tinseled favors offered by smooth leaders. We need to strive in every way possible for the revolutionary unraveling, a revolution of organized consciousness striking at the empire's heart with the full force of democracy, the kind of irresistible upsurge that seems to come from nowhere while carrying everything before it.
Well, that was from... Remember we interviewed Mike,
yeah.
Mike Parente. Most recent books are Cultural Struggle, of Contra, and, yeah.
Which book did we...
I can't remember. It wasn't one of these.
No.
It was during
he's,
his...
He's written a lot, though.
There was this book in, on Iraq. He wrote about 90 or so. And, but...
Well written.
Yeah, but
this is from his blog, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know. I get things. Actually, I'm going hoarse again.
Maybe we can put on a little audio.
There was one here that I wanted.
Reclaim your voice.
There was one right up here that I wanted. It was about the awakening. There is.
The sad truth. To why most people may not wake up.
So let's read that.
This is Mark Sawyer, MD.
So this is... I'm going horsey.
Well, you're about a week or so.
We're developing a society because of all of these different toxins known to affect brain function. We're seeing a society that not only has a lot more people of lower IQ, but a lot fewer people of higher IQ. In other words, a dumbing down, a chemical dumbing down of society. So everyone's sort of mediocre. That leaves them dependent on government because they can't excel. We have these people with lower IQ who are totally dependent. Then we have this mass of people who are going to believe anything they're told because they can't really think clearly. And very few people of very high IQ who have good cognitive function who can figure this all out. And that's what they want. So, you know, you can kind of piece it together as to why they are so insistent in spending so many hundreds of millions of dollars of propaganda money to dumb down society.
This is I think that this bomber isn't Al-Qaeda, isn't anything like that. It's a man. He's more like those 9/11 was an inside job kind of guys. They protesting in a violent way, but in a violent way almost like the echo terrorists, where they don't intend to inflict casualties.
Because they do it in the middle of the night.
Making a political point.
They could have killed people with it if it had been in the day, but they choose to do it at 3 a.m.
The cops have to go over there, and we just started with the commissioner. He has to go over and say, does that camera store have a security camera? Hey, can we see that? There's no master grid of all the cameras.
I think a lot of politicians, and I know you talk about that issue all the time, I think people should be careful what they wish for on China. You know, if China were to revalue its currency, or China is to start making, say, toys that don't have lead in them, or food that isn't poisonous, their costs of production are going to go up, and that means prices at Walmart here in the United States are going to go up, too. So I would say China is our greatest friend right now. They're keeping prices low, and
mercury-containing vaccines may help, not harm kids, according to two new studies in the journal
African-American.
Why did you have to tell them you were an atheist if you didn't have any trouble reading the oath? Why didn't you just shut up? What Jimmy Carter should do is privately give Mr. Bush's opinion and shut up publicly. That would be best for the country.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up once the fighting begins. Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
Can I just ask a question?
Sure.
What is Fox News? It's just a parade of propaganda, isn't it? It's just that. It's just a festival of ignorance. What? Why, a million people are dead in Iraq. Come on, this is ridiculous. What's the point of this?
Regarded by many as the father of public relations.
He was born in Vienna, Austria. Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Bernays pioneered the use of psychology and other social sciences to design public persuasion campaigns. He published several scholarly works still used in universities worldwide today. And he also spearheaded the national campaign to fluoridate the water supply of America through the fluoridationist of the Public Health Service. This is one proof that we captured the phosphate fertilizer industry, and having captured it, we can't dump it into the sea, but we put it into our own drinking water. It's extraordinary.
More fluoride in our water supply is a very real and ever-present risk to our population at large.
Dennis, let's make sure we're clear on this. Fluoride, it is in tea, it's in coffee, it's in water, it's in bread, it's in toothpaste, but it's actually a poison, right?
It sure is, and here's the quickest evidence. Go to your bathroom and pick up your toothpaste. And you'll see a warning that if a child swallows more than a pea-sized amount of toothpaste, call poison control.
Wow.
The protected pollutant status that fluoride enjoys within EPA and other federal establishments is remarkable, as the charts over here show.
Last November, concerns over excess fluoride prompted the American Dental Association to warn parents not to mix baby formula with tap water during an infant's first 12 months.
Philip Mullenix found that fluoride in very modest doses produces effects in laboratory animals resembling attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder.
She says, "Do you have any idea what you're saying?" And he says, "You're telling us that we're reducing the IQ of children." And basically I said, "Yes."
Scientists like Nobel Prize winner Arvid Carlson and a large group of EPA scientists have called for the banning of fluoride because we don't know how much we're ingesting, so we don't know if we're being poisoned.
Fluoride can also build up in the bones to cause pain, stiff joints, and skeletal abnormalities when they get older.
It's an cumulative poison. It just gradually builds up and it gradually causes harm.
Do you know when this fluoride was first put in drinking water? In the Nazi concentration camp. Stands back in amazement, can't believe it. This is Charles Perkins, a chemist who wrote to the Lee Foundation for Nutritional Research, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in 1954, and this is what he wrote. In the 1930s, Hitler and the German Nazis envisaged a world to be dominated and controlled by a Nazi philosophy of pan-Germanism. The German chemists worked out a very ingenious and far-reaching plan of mass control, which was submitted to and adopted by the German General Staff. This plan was to control the population in any given area through mass medication of drinking water supply. By this method, they could control the population in whole areas, reduce population by water medication that would induce sterility in women and so on. In this scheme of mass control, sodium fluoride occupied a prominent place. That's what it's about.
That truth why most people may not wake up because they're so
fluoride.
They're fluoridated.
Fluoridated and mercuried and everything else. So.
Now we got, I thought this was interesting. I don't know if this is in Europe. Let me go back.
Out of Connecticut water.
Yeah, we had Jim Russell from We Are Change who got a bill. I mean, it's just amazing that we would have to convince a Congress, you know.
We're a legislative body
about the poison that they're putting in our drinking supply that they knowingly or know they're putting in. And it's just, I don't know if they're stupid or if they're just.
They don't want to hear about it.
Totally complacent to the fact that.
Because that particular group isn't donating to their campaign.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. That group. try, Lila and I have been trying to tell the world what we know for
as have others,
1999.
As have other people.
Of course,
they've
I'm not saying that. We've got it from other
people, we've
got this information from other people. You can just come up with it, you know.
No, well, other people have tried to.
Of course.
But it's very difficult to
create
any change with the legislature. I hope Jim Russell, I'm amazed he was successful to even get as far as having them try to write a bill.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got to give him a lot of credit.
Somebody actually, I don't know, I've got so little hope. One more short video that I
want to. Man in India has not eaten food for 70 years.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, let's try that one. It's only a minute.
He's a breatharian, I guess.
Yeah, let's try it.
Miracle or myth?
Man says he's fasted for 70 years.
Evening for nearly 70 years. His claims are now being put to the test. A key Indian medical institute is observing him in a private hospital in the western state of Gujarat with already astonishing results.
That we are all watching a miracle in the science or biology, so to say, because it's already 108 hours since Mataji's admission into this hospital, and he has not eaten anything, he has not drank a little drop of any kind of liquid, but more importantly, he has not passed a drop of urine or stool.
The hospital has said that initial tests have shown the man has a brain resembling that of a 25-year-old, and that yogic exercises meant his body has undergone a biological transformation. Studying him could allow scientists and doctors to understand better how to survive without food or water for long periods, perhaps even help in exploring the universe.
India is now proposing to have missions to Moon, manned mission to Moon, and in the long run to Mars also. So how people can survive? This strategy, if you understand how people are surviving without food and water, that may help us in working out strategies for making people to live without food or water for longer duration.
Johnny will be under observation for a total of 15 days. He claims he was given the gift by the Hindu goddess Amba and that he nourishes himself with small amounts of nectar passing through his head. Fraudster or miracle man? India's medical world now looks to answer that very question. Imran Khan, Al Jazeera.
Hmm.
That
amazing.
It is.
I'm trying to get to that one. I can't find it, of course.
Which is
typical.
Well, we don't want to have dead air, Leo. We want to kick. Just move along.
Yeah. I'm sorry, folks, for the.
Oh, that's a guy I can't stand. Here's Morgan.
Oh, this one I wanted to mention. Because this one.
ABC, CBS, NBC admit no assault rifle used at Sandy Hook. ABC, CBS, and NBC all admit that the Bushmaster rifle was left in the car at Sandy Hook. Let's see what they have to say here. We have audio here.
Yep. I don't know what's wrong with these things.
Authorities had originally confused him with his older brother, Ryan. Took his own life. In addition to the handguns found near Lanza, he had a rifle in a car in the parking lot. All three weapons legally registered to his mother.
A very complex investigation, and there's a lot of contradictory information out there, but there is some new information this morning from a couple of federal officials and state officials. They say now that there were actually four handguns recovered inside the school, not just two, as we were initially told. Four handguns, and apparently only handguns, that were taken into the school. We knew that Adam Lanza, the man said to be the gunman here, also had a assault-style, AR-15-style rifle that he had taken to the school. It was in the car he drove there, his mother's car. But we've been told by several officials that he left that in the car.
By an assault rifle.
Mm-hmm.
Police say he was dressed in dark clothing and armed with two semi-automatic handguns, a 6-hour pistol, and a 9mm Glock, both highly effective weapons favored by law enforcement officials. It's still not known how many shots he fired, but the guns are capable of carrying extended magazines, which can hold up to 30 rounds of ammunition. 20 children spread over two classrooms were killed, as were 6 adults. The shooter was found nearby, dead of a self-inflicted gunshot. The two weapons were at his side. Evidence technicians are still mapping the killing zone, a challenge which Police Lieutenant Paul Vance says will take some time. We will be here through the night, certainly through the weekend. We're not even putting a time stamp on this as to when we will complete this project. Police also suspect Lanza may have thought about a broader attack. A third gun he took from his mother's home was found in the car. It's a .223 assault rifle.
Now, the one thing they didn't mention on this, which was really, quite, probably the most stunning,
was that
the coroner came out, and I saw it. I saw the news report. Claimed that all the children were killed, all the people were killed with an assault rifle. Every one of them. All right? He said that on television.
I don't remember.
Yeah, he said that. You didn't see it, of course. You weren't even there. But, I saw it.
I wasn't there.
You weren't there when they played it. You weren't there when they played it. You weren't here when they played it. All right? And when the coroner came out and said these were killed by an assault rifle. All right? And then he had such conflicting reports, it was unbelievable. And it was just one of the worst investigations I've ever seen. And something strange took place there, folks, and we're never going to find out about it. But, Eric Kohler, the Attorney General, came down that same day, quietly came down the day of Sandy Hook killing, to speak to the
state police, the first responders,
and he told them basically not to talk to anybody about this, all right? Because it was a setup, folks. It was a setup, and that's what happened. There was just so much conflicting testimony, conflicting reports to what really happened, and
lots of information, but no real truth. All kinds of misinformation.
All types of misinformation on this thing. It was unbelievable. Totally unbelievable. excuse me, I'm sorry. I'm losing my voice. All right, this one I wanted to play, if you don't mind, because...
We have three minutes.
Only 3 minutes of any worth from Davos.
How Iceland overthrew
the
banks. Very smart.
I thought it was very good. And this guy explains it. So, well, all the rest of Europe is in austerity and having problems and everything. This bank, Iceland, created its own and got itself
new
out
constitution
of
and everything
right.
else.
Right.
Very smart, those people.
Let's play that. It's only 3 minutes. So we'll wrap this up tonight.
Go out on a real positive note.
Well, so far, the only bit of hope that's come out of this Davos conference this year is from the Icelandic president, who's standing alongside me, Olafur Ragnar Grimsson. Mr. President, why are you such a beacon of hope? Why has Iceland survived where Europe has failed? What are you doing differently?
I think it surprises a lot of people that 4 years ago we were exhibit number one of a failed financial system. But now we are back on recovery with economic growth and very little unemployment. And I think the primary reason is that we were wise enough to realize this was also a fundamental social and political crisis. But above all, we didn't follow the traditional prevailing orthodoxies of the Western world in the last 30 years. We introduced currency controls, we let the banks fail, we provided support for the poor, we didn't introduce austerity measures of the scale you're seeing here in Europe. And the end result, 4 years later, is that Iceland is enjoying progress and recovery very different from the other European countries that suffered from the financial crisis.
So your policy of letting the banks fail, would that have worked for the rest of Europe?
I think so, because as I'm often asked people, why do they consider the banks to be the holy churches of the modern economy? Why are private banks not like airlines and telecommunication companies allowed to go bankrupt if they have been conducted in an irresponsible way? The theory that you have to bail out banks is a theory about bankers enjoying for their own profit the success and then letting ordinary people bear the failure through taxes and austerity. And people in enlightened democracies are not going to accept that in the long run.
It would work for the UK with their reliance on the financial sector, would it?
Well, this is an interesting question, because one thing we learned after the collapse of the banks in Iceland, that the Icelandic banks, like the British and the Americans and other banks, have in fact become high-tech companies, hiring engineers, mathematicians, computer scientists. And when they fail, the innovative sectors of our economy, the IT sector, the high-tech sector, in fact blossomed and have been doing much better in the last 3 years than ever before. So the lesson of that is that if you want your economy to be competitive in the innovative sector of the 21st century, a strong financial sector that takes the talent from these sectors, even a successful financial sector, is in fact bad news if you want your economy to be competitive in the areas which really are the 21st century areas, innovation, technology, IT.
President Grimsson, thank you very much indeed.
So they lure the good employees through greed and promises of millions and millions of dollars.
And
you don't pay for your mistakes either.
No.
But anyway, we're right at the end of the show. It's 9 o'clock, so we thank you very much for being with us. I hope you listen tomorrow night, where our slant is more on union news and a little bit of world news. So,
any issues, yes. So
thank you for being with us.
Yeah.
And I hope you have a great evening. Good night, folks.
Good night, everybody. I'm trying to get my music up here. Good night.